Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participant lines are in a listen-only mode. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Janitha, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop highlights from the 2012 American Society of Clinical Oncology, or ASCO, annual meeting. And this is a very ambitious program today. We're covering many different types of cancer today, and we have wonderful speakers. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and your interest in finding out what's latest and what's been reported at ASCO that we have so many of you on the call today. And we have over 557 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States, from all different regions. And we also have international participants from Canada, China, India, Taiwan, Pakistan, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that we received from Cancer Care. In those materials is information about all of the different collaborating organizations, about our speakers and the areas they're going to be covering. And there also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics you'd like us to offer going forward. Indeed, this particular ambitious program today was one that many of you recommended that we offer, and so here it is. And so please tell us what you'd like us to do, and we'll try very hard to implement your suggestions. You are our best resource and consultants as to what we should be offering and the topics we should offer in these programs. Now, today's program was made possible by Friends of Cancer Care, and we want to thank them for their support of the program today. We have really wonderful faculty, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Charles Laprinzi. Dr. Laprinzi is the Regius Professor of Breast Cancer Research, Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. And Dr. Laprinzi is going to address supportive care and quality of life issues, and really the latest information that was presented at this recent American Society of Clinical Oncology meeting. Dr. Laprinzi.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Messner. Pleasure to be on. I could go on for probably an hour talking about the interesting things, but I'll limit myself to the 12 minutes or so that I've been given here. I'll start off by mentioning something with chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, a big problem that many of us know about. When people get this problem, they can be given drugs such as procloperazine, or otherwise commonly known as compazine, or metoclopramide, otherwise known as Reglan, or one of the other medications we come to give to try to prevent nausea and vomiting. And there's a medication called olanzapine, O-L-A-N-Z-A-P-I-N-E, the medication that psychiatrists oftentimes use. And there have been a number of trials over the years suggesting that this is helpful for decreasing nausea and vomiting related to chemotherapy. And a study done this year showed in a placebo-controlled manner that patients who had nausea and vomiting after chemotherapy, when given olanzapine versus giving a placebo, had much less troubles with continued nausea or vomiting. So that's an exciting new thing. And further studies will probably be done looking at all the ways that it might be able to be used. Let me move on to talk about another problem that patients have, and that is fatigue. Fatigue is one of the biggest problems that many patients with cancer have. It affects patients when they are newly diagnosed and getting chemotherapy in a curative manner, and it affects people. It can continue to affect people for a long time after that, and patients who have cancer that has spread, come back, they can have a big problem with fatigue. So this year there was a trial looking at ginseng, the herbal preparation, versus placebo in patients with fatigue related to cancer. These were people who were getting chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting, so they were curatively treated, potentially cured, risk of recurrence, so they were given chemotherapy. Or it included patients who had finished their chemotherapy but did not have any evidence of recurrent cancer but still had fatigue. And in this placebo-controlled trial, demonstrated that the ginseng helped the fatigue to a moderate degree. It didn't totally take it away. There's not any medication we know that can totally take away cancer fatigue. This is a follow-up study from a previous trial done by Dr. Barton and her colleagues, and I happen to be one of them involved with this study, where we looked at the ginseng in various doses and saw, again, in this setting, and the previous trial was done in patients, included patients with advanced cancer, that there was decreased fatigue seen in the patients who got the higher doses of ginseng. So a couple of words with the ginseng. It's a product that's around in health food stores. It's not regulated, so you don't know what exactly is in the different products as opposed to different drugs that are regulated by the Federal Drug Administration, at least in the United States. So you have to be careful of that. In patients that have breast cancer, you do not want the type of ginseng that is alcohol-based. You want one that is water-based in terms of how they extract it. And you want the ginseng product that comes from the root of the plant. So if people are going to utilize this, it's 2,000 milligrams a day is what was utilized, and in a root product, and probably getting a compound that's done by a well-known company. Another fatigue study also was reported, and this looked at dexamethasone, or a steroid medication. And this was a specific group of patients. This was patients with advanced cancer, kind of people who were on hospice who had a lot of trouble with fatigue. And there they gave a two-week course of dexamethasone, and it improved fatigue in this group of patients. It was stopped after that. Dexamethasone or steroids can cause quite a bit of trouble if used for a longer period of time in patients, and therefore using it earlier in the disease course is not recommended because of the side effects that people can get. Another thing that's been utilized for treating fatigue over the years is methylphenidate, psychostimulants. Ritalin is oftentimes what it's known as. And there were a couple of abstracts this year that have really reinforced what we had seen before, and that is that this medication is not very helpful for cancer fatigue, despite early thoughts that it might be. Let me switch base to another area, and that's chemotherapy-induced neuropathy. Some patients getting chemotherapy can get numbness, tingling, shooting, burning pains in their hands and feet from drugs such as platinum drugs like cisplatinum or oxaliplatinum, or taxane drugs such as paclitaxel or docetaxel. And this can be a chronic problem that bothers them for months or years after they finish their chemotherapy. So this year there was a trial that looked at patients who had finished their chemotherapy and still had this problem, greater than 4 out of 10 severity of pain in the hands or the feet. And they were randomized to get duloxetine versus placebo. Duloxetine, the brand name is Cymbalta. It's a antidepressant medication similar to venlafaxine or Effexor. In this placebo-controlled trial, it demonstrated that there was a reduction in pain in the patients who got the duloxetine versus the placebo. It was not a home run. It was a single, if you will, but the first study that actually demonstrated something that could help decrease chemotherapy-induced peripheral neuropathy. The other drug that's oftentimes out there being used for this is gabapentin or pregabalin, otherwise known as Neurontin or Lyrica in this country. And it's used commonly, but the one study done there didn't demonstrate that it was very helpful. So in this particular trial where we looked at duloxetine was evaluated, 60% of patients on the duloxetine had a reduction in their pain versus 40% on the placebo. And it was in terms of the patients who had a 50% reduction of their pain, 20% of the people on duloxetine versus 10% of the people on placebo, a statistically significant decrease in pain, but again, something wasn't as helpful as we would like it to be. Let me move on. One other thing with neuropathy. So there's another drug that's out there. You can find it in health food stores and all, called acetyl L-carnitine. And there had been preliminary evidence suggesting that it was helpful for decreasing pain from chemotherapy neuropathy. There were two trials that were presented this year at ASCO, and one of them was done in China that took patients who had established chemotherapy neuropathy pain, and they reported that it decreased the pain in those patients. There were a lot. All the details of the study are not available, and we need to get the final manuscript to look at that. But at least it looked interesting. However, with that, there was another trial by an experienced group of investigators that looked at the same medication to see if it would prevent the neuropathy in patients who were receiving one of the taxanes, paclitaxel or docetaxel. It turned out that in that study, it actually caused worsening of the neuropathy. So patients had worse problems if you were trying to prevent it. So the bottom line on that drug is not out at this point in time. So let me switch base to talk about another common problem for patients with breast cancer. Patients who are on a medication called an aromatase inhibitor, such as anastrozole or letrozole, otherwise sometimes known as Arimidex or Femara. And these patients can have a lot of trouble with joint aches and pains. About 50% of patients will have problems with joint aches and pains, arthritis-type problems, and about 15% will have enough problem they say, I can't tolerate this. So this trial looked at vitamin D, and the evidence from the vitamin D versus placebo was supportive that it could decrease this pain problem. So they were started on the vitamin D at the time that they started the medication. The investigators said that this was interesting information, it was supportive, but it didn't prove it, and they recommended that further studies be done to better understand if it's going to be helpful or not, and I agree with that. Moving to another area, and that is looking at patients who have bony metastases, so cancer that's spread to bone. There's some information that a bisphosphonate-type medication, and I know that's a big word, but those are the class of medications that help to prevent bone loss, oftentimes used in people with osteoporosis. In this situation, it was zoledronate or zoledronic acid or Zometa was the medication that's used, given intravenously, similar to what people oftentimes know as Fosamax or alendronate or Boniva. And it's been given and helpful for decreasing bony problems like fractures and pain and need for radiation therapy. That's been shown previously in placebo-controlled trials, given once a month. It turns out that it does have some side effects, especially when you give it frequently. And so this study actually asked the question of whether, after people had received it for once a month for a year, whether they could receive it every 3 months and still get the same benefit and not and less toxicity. And this trial, the information from this trial suggested or supported that giving it once every 3 months was as good as giving it once a month for the second year. So hopefully this will become something that would become established. The authors thought that it needed to be further researched before they could feel certain that this, in fact, was a definite improvement over giving it once a month. Let me move on to another area. This area has to deal with patients who were on hospice, and the question that people have raised is it helpful when these patients are not taking in a lot of fluids? Is it helpful for them to get intravenous fluids? By a bottle of water or salt water given through a vein every day, and is that helpful for these patients? And so this was a randomized trial looking at this particular phenomenon, hoping that it would be helpful for them. And the bottom line was that it was not helpful. It was a placebo-controlled trial, so people didn't know what foods they were getting because they covered up the bottles. And one group just got a liter and a half a day of fluid, and the other one just got a few cc's of fluid. And the bottom line was that given the fluid in that situation, did not help the quality of life or length of life and was more problematic than beneficial. So I think I will stop there because of time constraints and let the program move on with other speakers.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Lipinski, for starting off today's program and for starting it off with such really important information that would help with people's quality of life and ability to tolerate treatment. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Mark Chris, and Dr. Chris is Chief Thoracic Oncology Service, the William and Joy Ruane Chair in Thoracic Oncology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and he's also Professor of Medicine at Medical College of Cornell University. And Dr. Chris is going to address new findings and reports about lung cancer at this meeting. I'm going to turn the program over to Dr. Chris.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Carolyn. I found this ASCO meeting to be a particularly exciting one. I have to say that looking over the program and the information that was released, it may be a little subtle, about how the developments that were presented really will change things, but I think that there is a lot of information there, and virtually every patient with a lung cancer can see an impact of one of these findings. I think the first observation is that we once again saw many, many abstracts pointing to the importance of testing for known drivers of cancer within the cancer cells, within biopsy specimens at the time of diagnosis. This has now become a standard of care. If you go to standard guidelines for how to treat lung cancer, it would say that you should do this mutation testing, particularly to test for the ALK and the EGFR genes. But I think more and more physicians have embraced the need to do this testing, the need to do it at the time of diagnosis, and the need to test for everything we can do something about. And there are probably 8 different targets now for which some treatment exists, and many of these were discussed at the ASCO meeting this year. This is a step toward personalized medicine where we try to choose the best treatment for a person, to use all the information we have available to make that choice, and the testing of tumors is very important. As far as the testing goes, we've seen information at this meeting, too, about the next generation of testing. Just like we can remember the old clunker computer, how much it cost, how little it would do, and how amazing the devices we have today are, the same is true with the testing of tumors for these genetic changes. So we're seeing dramatic changes, and these are changes that are months away, not years or decades away. There was a nice experience from a group of German investigators. These were doctors not in major academic centers, but in smaller community-based practices and hospitals that were able to do the same kind of genetic testing and get the same, you know, kind of information that they can use for patient care in a non-academic setting. I think that's one concern people have, that you can only do this at MD Anderson. Well, the truth is, here in the U.S., you can do it anywhere. Any doctor has access to this. We saw also the power of this information to, again, make better choices for individual patients. One good example of that was a paper by one of our doctors at Sloan Kettering about the exon 20 insertions in EGFR. Not all EGFR mutations are signs that a patient will be very sensitive to the drug erlotinib or gefitinib. And Dr. Arcila's paper showed that there are a lot of these exon 20 insertions that are found. In fact, there are about 10% of EGFR mutations. But what they mean is that those tumors will not be sensitive to gefitinib or erlotinib, and an alternative like a standard chemotherapy would be the best choice. Taking that one step further, Will, was an abstract by Dr. Costa from Boston. He looked at these exon 20 insertions and found that, yes, just as Dr. Arcila reported, the vast number of them say that cancers will not shrink if you receive erlotinib. However, if you have a specific one of them, then the cancer can shrink and would benefit for erlotinib. So the message there is we can get a lot of information out of this testing. Docs have to pay very close attention to the exact type of information they receive to make the best choices. And this kind of one-size-fits-all, you know, EGFR mutations mean sensitivity. That's not quite correct. EGFR exon 20 insertions mean resistance. Well, that's not quite correct either. You have to pay very close attention to the details, and our abstracts at this meeting pointed to that. What about those persons where we don't find a target? Well, as it turns out, there were multiple of these new targets discussed at the ASCO meeting, and particularly the one in ROS, R-O-S, ROS1. Alice Shaw from Mass General Hospital and investigators from around the country showed that if you have this ROS mutation or rearrangement in the ROS gene, it means that you will have sensitivity as you would if your tumor had an ALK rearrangement when you get the drug crizotinib. So bottom line is if you find one of these ROS rearrangements, it means that the cancer is very likely to shrink to crizotinib, a drug that's universally available now. So there's constantly more of these targets being discovered, and more importantly, when you discover one of these targets, there's an immediate therapeutic implication for your patients if you have a disease with this. So docs are in the process of setting up this testing, again, bringing the advantages of this targeted therapy to more and more patients. What we saw was a next-generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor, the drug called afatinib. This was an interesting trial in that it was one of the first trials where afatinib was only given to patients with EGFR mutations. It was a randomized study. Half of them got a chemotherapy. The other group got the afatinib alone. And what they saw was the group that had afatinib with the EGFR mutations had a much higher rate of tumor shrinkage and a much longer time free of cancer. The comparator here, too, was our best two chemotherapy drugs up front, pemetrexed and cisplatinum, and afatinib gave more shrinkages and kept the cancer away longer than even our best treatment. The hope is that this trial will lead to the quick approval of afatinib in the United States and worldwide, but yet another drug we can add in that is shown to be effective in the people with EGFR mutations. Dr. Pasares from Spain reported last year about the use of maintenance pemetrexed, but so-called continuation maintenance pemetrexed. So if after you completed your four or six cycles of standardized treatments, you would then be allowed to continue on the drug pemetrexed. He showed last year that the people that did that had a longer time free of cancer. What he showed this year is that those people lived longer by about an average of 4 months. So just by continuing the treatment that you started, you can get a lengthening of life. Great news. Again, this is immediately applicable to every person receiving pemetrexed, that by continuing it, not only will you have a longer time free of cancer, you'll also live longer as well. That came out at the ASCO. Information came out about squamous cancer. We've had many advances in adenocarcinoma. Not much has been said about squamous cancer. There was an abstract from my colleague, Paul Pack, that showed that when you tested squamous cancers for specific panels of mutations, you found them in more than half the patients, and that those mutations and changes in the genes in squamous cancer also could lead to therapeutic interventions. And he showed that for the FGFR1 gene, for example, it's present in maybe 20% of squamous cancers, and there's clinical trials for agents targeting that gene damage, in that patients that receive these investigational drugs have had their cancer shrink. So all the good stuff we said about adenocarcinoma, we can now say it about squamous cell, and that's a work in progress, and I think within the next year or two, we're going to find the squamous cells tested and much more information being given to patients and docs on how to treat squamous cell. The last thing that came up at the ASCO meeting this year was what are our next steps. I talked a lot about what do you do up front when you find an EGFR mutation, but we also know that eventually cancers find a way to grow despite the good results with initial gefitinib or erlotinib. So a number of abstracts came up at this meeting. One of them was that for many patients, simply continuing the gefitinib or erlotinib, even after there is some change, growth on a chest CT, particularly in those people that did not have any symptoms or any new spots of cancer, often could go for years by just taking that single pill a day and have good results. The second observation is that some of these people where most of the spots of cancer are quiet but one grows, if you treat that one spot, you can also have 1 to 2 years more of a very good and near normal life by simply treating that one spot with either an operation or radiation, treating of a single site metastasis. And lastly, for all patients with lung cancer, we always wanted a next step. We always wanted to harness the immune system. And we saw compelling data that many of you, I'm sure, saw in the news releases that by using the investigational agent's anti-PD-1 antibody or anti-PD-L1 antibody, we saw shrinkages in lung cancers of those cancers that grew even after standard treatment. These treatments are complementary to chemotherapy, they're complementary to targeted therapy, and they harness the immune system to work in the other ways that we have of fighting lung cancer. So I think there was a lot of great information there, a lot of hope for the future with things like PD-1 and PD-L1, hope for the future, and particularly patients with squamous cancers, that we're going to be able to test them routinely and that we're going to be able to go after the targets that we find in testing squamous cancer. For all the patients today, particularly those that have EGFR mutations, a lot more information about how best to use erlotinib. And again, a great opportunity to get more information at the time of diagnosis so you and your doctor can make the best treatment choices. I think that was the many messages of ASCO this year. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Chris. That was really a wonderful presentation, very, very comprehensive about lung cancer, and we thank you very much for that. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Lowell Anthony. Dr. Anthony is Professor of Medicine, Division of Medical Oncology, Markey Cancer Center, University of Kentucky. And Dr. Anthony is going to address updates on colorectal cancer, and it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Anthony.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. ASCO 2012 certainly was an exciting time to look at new data, and especially in colorectal as well. The messages that we're hearing time and time again in all the neoplasms is how do we go about best using our agents and how do we go about developing new drugs? So answers to these kind of questions did come out in several trials that were reported this year. One of the trials that followed earlier work where we were looking at EGFR inhibitors or erlotinib, as Dr. Chris was talking about earlier, it gave us greater insight in how to use this EGFR inhibitor with VEGF inhibitor bevacizumab in the management of patients with metastatic colorectal cancer who have completed first round of chemotherapy. This was a trial that Dr. Turnagain presented as the principal speaker for the GERCOR DREAM Phase 3 trial in Europe. And the take-home message from what Dr. Turnagain reported was that the results showed an increase in the patients, increase in progression-free survival in patients who got the combination of bevacizumab, an inhibitor for VEGF, given IV, with the oral drug, erlotinib, over giving just the bevacizumab alone. Now, this was a major finding because in previous studies where we've looked at other EGF inhibitors and specifically monoclonal antibodies such as cetuximab, these drugs that inhibit VEGF receptor at the molecular level, at the target, out on the cell surface, these studies have been shown to have toxicity, too much toxicity in the doses that were given. So about 4 years ago, the reports of these trials were reported, and it just looked like it was going to be a difficult thing to do. So what Dr. Turnagain was able to tell us that there's more to it than what we've learned in the past, even though there was an increase in some of the side effects that we see with EGFR inhibitors, such as diarrhea, such as skin toxicity. There is potential targeting of both targets, VEGF and EGFR, in colorectal cancer after all. So we're not quite there yet for making this prime time, but the story is not completed as we thought it was before this report. Another trial that Dr. Van Cutsem reported on was called the Phase 3 CORRECT trial, and this was a study looking at a multi-kinase inhibitor called regorafenib in metastatic colorectal cancer. Now, this is an oral drug that was compared to placebo in patients who had chemo-refractory metastatic colorectal cancer, and this was some data that was presented in January at GIASCO in San Francisco, and now repeated this in June. So we've had some time to digest this trial, and it looks like we've got an oral agent targeting the specific signaling pathways that, when we've looked at these pathways with other agents, has not been particularly helpful. So this study that Dr. Van Cutsem reported on was looking at overall survival, progression-free survival in all different subgroups, and it really looked like that the KRAS status was not predictive. So this was a monumental day where we have now more to offer colorectal cancer patients that that may have KRAS mutations that this particular drug was not contraindicated in that particular subset. And the other aspect of Dr. Van Cupsen's work is where there's something good, he also said that the toxicities were most manageable, so the adverse events were not something that were going to potentially decrease quality of life significantly. Now, moving on, another report that Dr. Dirk Arnold reported on was looking at how we best should use bevacizumab. Historically, we've been using it for the last decade with chemotherapy in the first-line setting, and it's really been considered a mistake in continuing it beyond progression. So what Dr. Arnold reported out in what's called the TML study, this is where patients with metastatic colorectal cancer who were getting just standard chemotherapy and bevacizumab were randomized between giving second-line chemotherapy with the bevacizumab or just the chemotherapy alone. So this study showed that there was benefit in continuing the bevacizumab. So what's been looked at as a therapeutic era in continuing a drug when it's no longer working, it appears that the chemotherapy is more important in not continuing that from first line rather than continuing the monoclonal antibody that targets VEGF. So this kind of message now is being supported by other studies where bevacizumab has been used in observational studies. And so the argument now is being built, not just this, but this is the first scientific prospective randomized trial that's really confirmed some of the early observational trials. Now, another abstract by Dr. Allegra, Carmen Allegra, University of Florida, what Carmen reported on was the Velour study, and this was a phase 3 study looking at a VEGF trap drug called aflibercept. And VEGF trap would work similarly to bevacizumab, but it has a little broader activity in that not only recognizing the VEGF A, but it also recognizes other VEGF substrates, A and placental growth factor, B and placental growth factor. So we've got a drug now that circulates in the blood that recognizes these receptors and can block the agent from activating its pathway. So this product is studied in the resistant setting of where patients had completed chemotherapy or failed chemotherapy to oxaliplatin and then randomized to an irinotecan-based regimen combined with 5-FU called FOLFIRI. And when the aflibercept was added to that, then there was benefit. And this would, again, even though it's not the same as bevacizumab, it would imply that continuing to influence VEGF-mediated pathways post-resistance to first-line chemotherapy is a meaningful interaction. So we're really changing the paradigm of how to think about influencing VEGF receptors. Now, the another study that looked at people who had resectable metastatic colorectal cancer was reported by Dr. Mohamed Hebbar from the GERCOR study called MIROX, M-I-R-O-X. And what the MIROX study did was to look at a regimen called FOLFOX, which is a 5-FU oxaliplatin folinic acid regimen where they infuse 5-FU and give bolus as well, but they looked at it versus a sequential FOLFOX-7 that omits the bolus 5-FU so you don't get as much myelosuppression, but then they followed that with an irinotecan-based regimen, the FOLFIRI. So looking at 12 cycles of the FOLFOX-4 versus six cycles of FOLFOX7 followed by six cycles of FOLFIRI, and then taking these patients to the operating room for resectability. And what Dr. Hebar concluded was that it really didn't make any difference that the FOLFOX-based regimens were really not superior. That was the adding FOLFIRI was not superior to FOLFOX, so that the standard way we've done this is to use FOLFOX therapy, and then sequentially adding iRENO has not added any greater benefit in terms of resectability. This would be important because the more chemotherapy-type drugs we give, the more likely there could be hepatic toxicity, something that we call chemo liver. So, Carolyn, I'll just stop right there and turn it back over to you.
Well, thank you very much. That was really an excellent presentation, Dr. Anthony, very comprehensive as well, and lots of information for everybody. So thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. John Leonard. Dr. Leonard is the Richard T. Silver Distinguished Professor of Hematology and Medical Oncology. He's also Professor of Medicine, Weill Cornell Medical College. He's also Clinical Director, New York Cornell Center for Lymphoma and Myeloma, and he is Chief Lymphoma Myeloma Service and Associate Director for Clinical Research, Weill Cornell Cancer Center. And Dr. Leonard is going to address lymphoma and updates on lymphoma from ASCO. Dr. Leonard?
Well, thank you very much, and it's a great pleasure to be here today. Lymphoma and new developments in lymphoma are covered at really two major international meetings, for the most part, that American physicians participate in, the American Society of Hematology, which is held in December every year, and then the ASCO meeting, which is a subject of this teleconference. And so we often have at two different points in times of the year, we have either new data presented or updates on studies that may have been presented at one meeting or another. So I'll give you a brief update on what came out of ASCO. I think the study that got the most attention was presented at the plenary session of the ASCO meeting. And again, the plenary session is really the session where the top few presentations are made that are felt to be of interest to the entire membership of ASCO, regardless of their particular subspecialty interest within oncology. And so this was an update of a study that has been previously presented most comprehensively back in 2009, which focused on the best way to treat patients with follicular and other indolent lymphomas. So indolent lymphomas are really mostly what we call non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. We'll come back to Hodgkin lymphoma in just a minute. But these tumors of the lymph tissue that are non-Hodgkin's lymphomas are really broken into a couple of big categories, and one of the major categories is called indolent lymphomas. These are chronic, slow-growing lymphomas that patients can live for many, many years with and are managed often like diabetes or high blood pressure for many patients, not all patients, where we focus on controlling the disease over time and unfortunately are not able to get rid of it, but many patients live a relatively normal life where they may be on and off treatment over various periods, over hopefully decades with the disease. And so there is a lot of controversy or discussion about what's the best way to treat follicular and other indolent lymphomas, as well as mantle cell lymphoma, which is another less common subgroup of lymphomas. And so because many different treatments are available and there can be different choices for patients depending on their preferences as far as the side effect profile that they're willing to put up with. And so what this study, plenary session study, reported on was a chemotherapy drug called bendamustine. It's also known as Treanda by the trade name. This is a chemotherapy drug that is often given in combination with rituximab, which is a monoclonal antibody, an immune protein that helps fight the lymphoma. And the other treatment regimen in this study was called CHOP, which is a combination, an older combination of four drugs, plus also the same antibody treatment, rituximab. And so this study included several hundred patients, over 500 patients with indolent lymphomas, including follicular lymphoma and mantle cell lymphoma, and randomized patients from one treatment to another. And basically, the conclusion of this study, which is, again, an update of older information, was that in many ways, the bendamustine rituximab, essentially the newer treatment regimen, was easier for patients to tolerate from the perspective primarily of the fact that patients did not generally lose their hair with this treatment. And in some ways was a little bit easier as far as other side effect profiles, such as neuropathy or numbness and tingling of the fingers and toes with blood counts and infections. So the bendamustine rituximab in this particular study seemed to be better with regard to the side effect profile, and importantly, and perhaps even more importantly for patients, kept patients in remission longer from their disease after receiving this therapy versus the R-CHOP therapy, which is the older, more commonly used treatments, at least historically. So this study, I think that is why it was presented at the plenary session. This was felt to be a very important paper. I think that many people in practice are using the bendamustine rituximab combination either as initial treatment for follicular and mantle cell and other indolent lymphomas on the basis of this and other studies, or in the relapse situation as a second, third, fourth treatment, et cetera, when patients go on to need more therapy. And so I think this is important for patients, again, with many types of lymphoma, including indolent lymphomas and mantle cell lymphoma, to recognize that this is a new treatment option, again, bendamustine plus rituximab for certain situations, and something that is, again, in some ways more effective and in some ways has fewer side effects than some of the older standard treatments. So something for patients to keep in mind and discuss with their physicians. We reported a second study also in the follicular and other follicular lymphomas, again, one of the indolent lymphomas. This was a study done by one of the cooperative groups called the Cancer and Leukemia Group B, which is subsequently been renamed as part of a larger group called the Alliance for Clinical Trials in Oncology, where we treated patients with relapsed follicular lymphoma receiving their second, third, fourth, and beyond treatments with a drug called lenalidomide. Lenalidomide is a pill. It is a cousin of an older drug called thalidomide. Both of these drugs are FDA approved for the treatment of multiple myeloma and are sometimes used and have been studied in other types of lymphoma and other blood cancers. And so this trial randomized patients to receive the lenalidomide alone or lenalidomide in combination with rituximab, again, this antibody immune protein treatment, in patients with recurrent or relapsed follicular lymphoma. And the bottom line of this study was that the patients who received two drugs, the lenalidomide rituximab combination, seemed to have higher response rates, meaning their tumors shrunk more frequently and to a larger extent, and stayed in remission longer. And so this suggested that basically this combination may be a reasonable treatment option for certain patients with recurrent follicular lymphoma. I will note that there is a large national, actually international, study going on, or a couple of them, depending on the part of the world where one lives, where this lenalidomide rituximab combination is being compared to standard chemotherapy regimens plus rituximab as the first line or initial treatment for patients with indolent or follicular lymphoma. And so the concept, and I bring this study up, while it may not change practice for or change the standard of care for patients right now, I think it is important to keep in mind that this combination, lenalidomide plus rituximab, may be useful for patients with not only follicular lymphoma but other subtypes of lymphoma where it's been studied. But I think most importantly, it shows how we're moving toward the concept, at least in indolent lymphomas, where we can treat patients with combinations of therapy called biologic agents, where patients can avoid or at least delay chemotherapy for a period of time. And so this is something that I think is attractive to many patients, to have a treatment option or regimen that does not include the side effects of chemotherapy, although like any drug, the lenalidomide rituximab does have its own side effects, but moving towards a more chemotherapy-free type of treatment regimen in some situations is obviously appealing for patients. There were a number of other studies that looked at various aspects of lymphoma, including studies that looked at patients with HIV-associated lymphoma. HIV is associated with some patients in lymphoma. It's a risk factor for certain lymphomas, and basically gave a fair amount of good information suggesting that in many cases, patients with HIV and lymphoma can do quite well with their treatment, and that a key issue is making sure that those patients have appropriate care both for their lymphoma and their HIV. And for those patients out there who have HIV and either lymphoma or other cancers, that's becoming an increasingly common observation, that as patients with HIV are doing better and living longer and we have better therapies for HIV itself, that those cancers that are associated with HIV can also have improved outcomes as patients are treated appropriately in those situations. I want to now move briefly to Hodgkin lymphoma, which is another area that is important. Hodgkin lymphoma, or Hodgkin's disease as it's commonly known, the vast majority of patients do quite well with standard chemotherapy or radiation. We have a new drug called brentuximab vedotin. This is what's called an antibody treatment that has a drug attached to the antibody or the immune protein that allows one to deliver this toxin more specifically to the tumor cells. But I just want to briefly mention one study that has taken patients with higher risk. A small group of Hodgkin's patients do less well than other patients, although still most of those higher risk Hodgkin's lymphoma patients are still cured of their disease with standard therapies. And so there was a randomized trial that took patients with this higher risk Hodgkin's lymphoma and randomly assigned them to either receive one of the standard chemotherapy regimens called ABVD, or a more intensive chemotherapy regimen called BIACOP, which might be more effective in the higher risk disease, at least that's what previous studies had shown, but has more side effects to the patient. And this was a randomized trial that essentially said, in these higher risk patients, is it worthwhile to give the stronger BIACOP therapy because these patients have a little bit less favorable outcome? Is it worth in these patients giving them a stronger therapy that might work better but unfortunately has greater side effects? And the bottom line of this study was that the benefits of using the stronger, more toxic therapy did not seem to come through. Basically, in the long term, patients who received the standard ABVD treatment could do just as well in the long term. And so this really suggests that giving the stronger BIACOP therapy did not add a great deal of value to these patients. And I think the future in Hodgkin lymphoma therapy, just as it is in other lymphomas, as well as other cancers, is coming up with better tools to figure out who's going to do better or worse, whether that is using special scans like PET scans, whether that's using profiling, using biopsies and other sophisticated tests based on those tissue analyses, those tumor tissue analyses, to try to identify better therapies and more specifically how patients are going to do, and to use novel, more targeted drugs rather than just giving higher doses of chemotherapy. In many situations, I think many of us believe that that's where we'll have a greater impact for our patients. And that's obviously the way that one of the themes of many of these presentations that you're hearing today relate to. Can we better identify who's going to do better, who's going to do worse, and can we act upon that with better, more targeted drugs? So I think with that, I will finish. Those are many of the high points relating to lymphoma at the ASCO meeting, and I'll turn it back over to Carolyn and the other speakers.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Leonard. Just a wonderful presentation and really covering such a wide area. So thank you, and very helpful to all the participants. And our next speaker on today's program is Dr. Michael Morrow. Dr. Morrow is Associate Professor, Center for Hematologic Malignancies, Knight Cancer Institute at Oregon Health and Science University. And Dr. Morrow is going to address advances that were reported at ASCO for leukemia, all the updates. And now it's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Morrow.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm going to try to keep my comments brief because I don't want to have us run over time. So ASCO is more of an oncology meeting, as we know, so solid tumors and even the solid heme malignancies are often covered a little bit more. But and many of you know my bias is CML, so I'm going to make sure I cover what was updated in CML as well. I first like to just mention, I think it was a real honor that Dr. Kanti Rai received the Karnofsky Award for his work in CLL, and he's been a pioneer in CLL, and that disease has seen tremendous advances moving forward from our initial therapies with alkylating agents, then with purine analogs such as fludarabine and antibody therapy with rituximab, and a host of new targeted therapies and much better disease profiling. We're able to really classify CLL as a disease of higher or lower risk and treat it appropriately and incorporate a host of new targeted therapies. So that was quite an honor. Let me cover again what I have at my fingertips, which would be the information on CML. And in the oral presentation at ASCO for 2012, there were a couple of important updates. The field of CML has seen a revolution in the last decade or more. And in 2012, we're at the point where we have multiple approved agents useful in CML. We have imatinib, nilotinib, and dasatinib. And at ASCO 2012, we saw presented an update of 3 years of treatment with dasatinib, a second-generation oral kinase inhibitor for patients with newly diagnosed CML. And the kind of questions we've been asking about are using our newer and stronger drugs initially for patients with CML is how well do they perform? Are they more protective? And is any risk offset by any benefit? I think the message is quite clear. I think we see clear improvements in molecular responses. And this really seems to be the holy grail of CML. At a minimum, what's called a major molecular response is accepted as a surrogate endpoint with evidence of benefit. Deeper molecular responses where patients have essentially borderline or no evidence of detectable BCR-ABL signal or method for CML also improved with using second-generation drugs like dasatinib over imatinib. Secondly, beyond response would be preventing patients from progressing, and transformation rates are reduced. And particularly with using our second-generation drugs and the data presented with dasatinib, we see now that we really are getting much better at identifying who isn't being served well enough by their therapies very early on. We saw data around the three-month mark, so only 3 months into treatment with a newer drug, we're able to decide, is this drug performing well enough for the patient, and can we continue with that therapy because the odds of cytogenetic and molecular, the important milestones or missions are happening or not? So that presentation really, I think, sealed in our minds the concept that molecular remission, protection against progression, and early delineation, essentially cutting down the number of patients at risk. And unfortunately, the patients who don't respond, they're much smaller number. They may be a more distinct profile and they may need other therapies, clearly, even early at a three-month mark with their first treatment. And there's some anxiety over what to do when we use our second-generation drugs first. Another important presentation at ASCO 2012 was on ponatinib. Ponatinib is a third-generation BCR-ABL inhibitor, and another oral drug in the same class, if you will, as imatinib or Gleevec and nilotinib and dasatinib. And we saw updated data from the phase 2 trial called the PACE trial of ponatinib. And this drug, I think, really is showing how much we've evolved in the field of kinase inhibitors, oral small drug. oral small molecule inhibitors for BCR-ABL. This drug, with a larger study beyond the phase 1 now in phase 2, is showing essentially better results than we saw in phase 2. So when we had Gleevec-resistant patients or patients who weren't being served well enough with Gleevec and we treated them with dasatinib and nilotinib, they did well. I think the response rates for patients who unfortunately have failed multiple therapies, have failed imatinib and nilotinib, imatinib and dasatinib, or all three, or sometimes four drugs in this case, the response rates were quite dramatic, with early response early cytogenetic and early molecular response rates being, again, somewhat even better than we saw with second-line therapy now in the third line. And this is with early follow-up, a median of almost 6 months. So I think as we follow the study more time, we'll see even better results. Particularly patients who have a highly resistant mutation, the T315I mutation, are served particularly well by ponatinib. So our anxiety level about what to do for a patient who proves themselves not to be doing well enough on a second-generation kinase inhibitor may be mitigated by the fact that panantinib will hopefully soon be available, and our highly resistant cases also can be managed with panantinib. In addition, at ASCO, we saw information about something a bit on the other end of the spectrum. How can we improve on someone who's on imantinib doing well, on Gleevec and doing well, and can we push them into a deeper level of remission? Can we push them into a so-called complete molecular remission? It's a bit of a misnomer, but it really is a push someone to the threshold at which leukemia levels or BCR-ABL transcripts aren't detectable any longer. And there was a study called the NSCMR study, which I think very nicely showed that we can put a significant fraction of patients into a quote, complete molecular remission, or CMR, by switching them to nilotinib. So taking a imantinib-treated patient who's doing well and now move into a second-generation drug, and we can see improved performance. One other presentation was long-term follow-up for patients who had failed imantinib, or imantinib had failed them, rather, and who switched to dasatinib. And I think what we saw is that over the long term, patients who managed to have early stability and early response do very well. The progression rates are very low, and that the toxicity really does mitigate over time, and the durability of responses with dasatinib look quite good. Again, the number of patients continuing on long-term studies several years after their initiation are small, but I think when we study such a fraction, we learn important lessons about how stable a salvage response might be. So I think the perspective on CML at ASCO 2012 was that we have some new approaches to optimize response. We have probably even more evidence that our second-generation drugs are useful in the first-line setting and really are probably superior. In addition to the oral presentation for dasatinib, there was three-year-plus data with nilotinib, which is looking very strong, with cytogenetic and molecular responses showing statistical advantage, statistical protection against progression, and very good tolerability. So the future is very bright for all of us, and our hopes are somewhat encouraged, and our fears are somewhat assuaged by the likely arrival of newer drugs like panantinib. And what's on the horizon next for CML is how do we approach a functional cure. And so stay tuned for other meetings and other presentations for information on that. So I'll close and leave time for my colleagues. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Morrow. That was really wonderful, and actually just wonderfully a lot of good information for people to hear about leukemia and its treatment and CML and its treatment and many of the advances that were reported. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Terry Day, and Dr. Day is Professor and Director, Head and Neck Tumor Center, Hollings Cancer Center, Medical University of South Carolina. And Dr. Day is going to address oral and head and neck cancer and the reports at ASCO. Dr. Day?
Thank you, Carolyn. It is again a pleasure to join Cancer Care and provide an update on head and neck cancer in 2012. It's apparent that head and neck cancer seems to be getting additional publicity in the recent years at ASCO and other research conferences. It's exciting. There's a lot of new research, and I'm honored to present some of this information today. For those who aren't familiar with it, head and neck cancer typically refers to squamous cell carcinoma, and this is a cancer that arises in the lining or the mucosal surfaces of the mouth, oral cavity, the throat or pharynx, and the voice box or larynx. It can arise in other areas too, and many know that squamous cell cancers arise on the skin also. There are other cancers of the head and neck that we often talk about, including salivary gland, thyroid, even skin cancers like squamous cell and basal cell cancers and melanoma. But for the purposes of today's discussions, we won't be discussing those other cancers. As most people are aware, head and neck cancers can occur in the tongue, throat, and voice box, but may also spread to the lymph nodes of the neck. Early diagnosis and treatment is important, and people should know that the first signs might be a red or white patch in the mouth or throat, a sore throat, difficulty swallowing, or a change in voice. Some people notice swollen lymph nodes in the neck as the first sign. We encourage everybody with a new head and neck cancer to seek multidisciplinary evaluation with a surgeon, a medical oncologist, and a radiation oncologist, and oftentimes a dentist or speech and swallowing therapist is necessary also. So to move on to today's topic, most of the abstracts this year at the ASCO meeting were related to biologic therapies or molecular targeted therapies and combinations of chemotherapy and radiation therapy. Since most early stage, which is stage 1 or 2, head and neck cancers are treated successfully with surgery or radiation therapy, we won't discuss these topics today, but rather focus on advanced cancers, which are stage 3 or 4, where non-surgical or surgical therapy may play a role. So I've organized the next 10 minutes into sections on number 1, HPV, or human papillomavirus-related cancers. Number 2 is locoregionally advanced head and neck cancer. And number 3 is recurrent, or cancers that have come back after prior treatment, but also metastatic, or cancers that have spread to other parts of the body. And we'll organize those into those sections. But before we dive into those topics individually, it's worth mentioning some comments regarding the terms personalized medicine and molecular and genetic-based therapies. And some of these ideas were discussed by several speakers at ASCO, including Dr. Sadransky from Johns Hopkins. He discussed opportunities in the future for genetic information about head and neck cancers to identify which treatment might work for an individual cancer. This is not the current standard of care, but is the focus of ongoing research and is exciting for all of us in the field. One FDA-approved molecular or biologic therapy is cetuximab, and reports at ASCO have discussed this drug as well as combinations with this drug, in addition to potential for overcoming resistance to this drug by some head and neck cancers. So now to move on to HPV, or human papillomavirus. And I think that one of the reasons head and neck cancer has received so much attention in the media and during Oral Head and Neck Cancer Awareness Week is because of the findings over the past decade by Dr. Gillison and others that most oropharyngeal, or base of tongue and tonsil cancers, are associated with human papillomavirus. While the incidence of cervical cancer has declined over the past decade, the incidence and rates of oropharyngeal cancers in men has increased and surpassed the total number of cervical cancers. Studies have shown that HPV-related cancers are more common in the base of tongue and tonsil, in younger patients, males, and non-smokers. Although it is well established that HPV-positive cancer patients have a better cure rate than those that are HPV-negative, studies remain ongoing to determine if reducing the amount of radiation or chemotherapy allows for the same cure rate with reduced side effects. Other researchers have shown that the tumor suppressor gene, P53, and EGFR, or epidermal growth factor receptor, play an important role in tumor growth, and that these targets continue to be studied in patients with HPV-related cancers and non-HPV-related cancers. Finally, the group at Johns Hopkins presented some interesting findings related to the immune mechanisms in HPV-associated head and neck cancer that have a strong immune response from the patient's own immune system. They showed that through the PD-1, PD-L1 pathway, there's an immune resistance mechanism that seems to be in the tonsillar region, allowing for tumor growth and reduced immune response. This pathway may be a potential target for preventing or treating these tumors. I'll move on to the second category, locoregionally advanced. This generally refers to stage 3 or 4 cancers that might be where the cancer started, which was the primary site, or in the neck lymph nodes. Regarding N2 or N3 disease, and this means to the stage of the neck, which N stands for the lymph nodes of the neck, and N2 or 3 are the advanced categories. Dr. Cohen presented on 280 patients in the DECIDE trial, which compared induction chemotherapy, which means chemotherapy before other treatments, with docetaxel, cisplatin, and 5-FU, followed by chemotherapy and radiation, and compared that to chemo radiation alone or at the same time. The overall cure rate was similar in these two different groups, but the distant failure rate, or the spread of the cancer to other parts of the body, was higher in the non-induction group. In another study, Dr. Haddad presented results of the PARADIGM trial, which also compared sequential, or in order, docetaxel, cisplatin, and 5-FU, followed by chemotherapy and radiation therapy, to cisplatin and radiation in locally advanced head and neck cancer. Of the 145 patients that were enrolled in this study, there was no difference in the survival rates, with reasonable cure rates in both groups. In another international phase 2 trial evaluating the efficacy of panitumumab, which is a human monoclonal antibody against the EGFR, 150 patients were enrolled, and they were to receive cisplatin with radiation therapy or cisplatin with radiation therapy and panitumumab. There were increased side effects and some delay in the radiation therapy in the panitumumab group, but no difference in the cure rates. Erlotinib is another treatment, and it is a small molecule inhibitor of the epidermal growth factor receptor, and it was studied in combination with cisplatin and radiation therapy and compared to another group of patients receiving cisplatin and radiation therapy alone, and these were locally advanced head and neck cancers. The addition of the erlotinib increased the incidence of rash and some gastrointestinal side effects, but no serious adverse events were noted and no effect on the survival. I'm going to go now to the final category, which is recurrent and metastatic head and neck cancers. And in the international phase 3 spectrum study, which included 653 patients with recurrent and metastatic head and neck cancer, 447 of the patients had HPV testing, and 22% of these patients, and this is a global study, had HPV-related cancers. This study compared panitumumab, which I mentioned earlier, with chemoradiation therapy to chemoradiation alone without the panitumumab. The results were analyzed by HPV status. Interestingly, the HPV-positive cancers occurred in 37% of the oropharynx tumors, 19% of the larynx tumors, and 15% of the oral cavity tumors. The panitumumab arm had an improved cure rate only in the HPV-negative group. And in the final study I'll mention today, it was a French study, GORTEC 2008-03, evaluated cetuximab, docetaxel, and platinum in recurrent and metastatic head and neck cancer. They found the progression-free survival to be acceptable, suggesting that this might be a first-line treatment in this subset of patients. So to summarize, head and neck cancers are now being studied in numerous clinical trials, and newer studies are evaluating molecules that may be targeted to improve customized treatment for these patients and those cancers, improving cure rates while hopefully improving quality of life. For now, it is well known that stage 1 and 2 cancers can be treated successfully with surgery or radiation, while stage 3 and 4 cancers may require various combinations or sequences of chemotherapy, radiation therapy, and surgery. Thanks to Cancer Care again for hosting this session. I hope I've provided some new and helpful information. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Day, and you certainly have provided some wonderful information for everybody on the call today. Very helpful. Thank you so much. And our next speaker and our final speaker for today's program is Dr. Gregory Daniels. And Dr. Daniels is Associate Clinical Professor of Medicine, the University of California in San Diego, Rebecca and John Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Daniels is going to address melanoma and the updates at ASCO. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Daniels.
Thank you, Caroline, and thank you, Cancer Care, for doing this. This is very important, and I want to share, hopefully, some of the excitement that the other speakers have. It was an incredible meeting this year, and I'll focus on melanoma. And first, just a little bit of background, melanoma, and I'll limit things to mostly the skin occurring melanomas. As probably your callers know, melanomas can occur both on the skin as well as in other places in the body. Skin melanomas are getting more attention because they're becoming more common. Particularly, recent reports have shown in all age groups, but specifically in the younger age group, so the young adults, where the incidence of melanoma is going up dramatically every year. Fortunately, most of these melanomas are thin. They're being brought to the attention and taken care of by either a primary care physician or a dermatologist. And so understanding that this is happening in the skin is very important. Early action is very important, recognizing melanoma and taking care of it before you need to talk about all the exciting stuff going on at ASCO. But this year was exciting, and I'll focus on two themes. As some of the other speakers have emphasized, where oncology is going is improving our understanding, trying to understand what factors are happening within the tumor and surrounding the tumor that help us guide and predict response to therapy and help guide therapy. So this is a big push in personalized medicine or personalized oncology, and it's based on our genetic understanding of what's going on in the tumor. Melanomas can happen anywhere on the skin, but a few years back it was observed that depending on where the melanoma was occurring, the genetics differed. One change that has gotten a lot of attention over the last couple years is in the BRAF gene. And so the first part of my discussion will be limited to that. Last year, Dr. Chapman and others presented incredible information on the use of a BRAF inhibitor, vemurafenib, that for those patients with this genetic change, that we look at it as an Achilles heel for the cancer. If you inhibited this gene product or the protein that is mutated in some patients with melanoma, we saw dramatic results within days for patients that were maintained much longer than before. And so one of the first talks that I'd like to just highlight would be from Dr. Chapman, again, updating the results from the BRIM3 study with vemurafenib, confirming what we saw early on, which was a benefit for not only response in patients, and responses were significant to improve quality of life, but as this was a comparative study, there was a significant improvement in overall survival. And so up until about 2010, melanoma wasn't, I would say, stuck, but we weren't making huge progress in terms of improving outcomes for patients. 2011 opened the door, and now 2012 has really sealed the deal in that we've practically doubled the average survival for patients, understanding the genetics that are going on in their tumor with medications that are tailored to them and are easy to deliver. Some of these medications are oral. Certainly they have side effects, and so Dr. Chapman updated us on the side effects seen. At the same time, a second BRAF inhibitor was presented, and this was by Caroline Robert, and the compound was similarly compared to chemotherapy, which had been our standard of care in treating patients, and I'm thankful to say is no longer our standard of care for first-line treatment for melanoma. So this was trametinib, an oral agent given 2 milligrams once a day, so a once-a-day pill, led to similar dramatic responses as vemurafenib the year prior. In this case, it was a crossover design for the study, but again, it was observed to have survival advantage for patients. So now in 2012, we have two targeted agents for a gene that's mutated in about half the patients with skin melanomas. So a very exciting time. However, it's an overwhelming meeting with lots of data, and they focus down on, well, what about the other half of the patients that don't have BRAF mutations? Why can't these medications work forever? What's holding them up? And so as far as resistance, Dr. Sossman presented some data looking at in patients that were treated with the BRAF medication that then went on to have their tumors start to grow despite getting this medication. The pathway that's inhibited for BRAF, this MAP kinase pathway, is central to the escape of some of these tumors for a substantial number of patients. And he presented data looking at biopsies of patients that had progressed and then what secondary changes, or in other words, what are the other targets that we might be able to exploit to regain control of the cancer? And so this MAP kinase pathway was reactivated in a substantial number of patients, and he found, as well as his colleagues, Tony Rebus and others, that there are mutations in other genes in this pathway, for example, in NRAS, which bring up possibilities for adding in other drugs. Again, things are moving so quickly, we've already added in other drugs. And one of the drugs that would be predicted to improve benefit in BRAF mutated patients would be a MEK inhibitor. Jeff Weber from Moffitt presented a very nice presentation looking at a phase 1, phase 2 study looking at trametinib, the one that I just mentioned, with a MEK inhibitor, dabrafenib. And in this combination study, it was looking at doses, it was very clear that the hypothesis that he presented going into it, maybe we could improve the time that the disease is controlled. And interestingly, it would be predicted that some of the toxicities may be lower, data that was presented last year's ASCO, turned out to be true, that the progression-free survival of a combination therapy targeting these genetic changes had both a longer progression-free survival as well as what appeared to be a decrease in the amount of skin toxicity associated with it. It's still early on, but very promising. This is not comparative data, but the time of disease control was longer than we would have expected with just the BRAF inhibitor alone. So more combination studies are ongoing. These MEK inhibitors, a MEK-162 drug was presented because MEK, being as part of this pathway, is not the BRAF. It's not dependent on having BRAF changes. So it would be predicted that perhaps other gene changes, such as NRAS, may respond to a MEK inhibitor. And it's true. And data presented by Dr. Asiento with this MEK-162, a phase 2 study, showed that not only in BRAF-mutated patients, but NRAS-mutated, so non-BRAF mutations, so another 20% of patients, were being helped by an oral medication taken twice a day, showing more than a 50% what we call disease control rate. So this is clinical benefit for patients where their tumors are either stable or they're shrinking, and this benefit appeared to last for months for this oral medication. So pretty exciting time in terms of understanding maybe rational combinations and what mechanisms there are for resistance. So that's the targeted therapy side of melanoma. And I'll pick up a theme that was our last presenter said, and that's immunologic. And what's happened for melanoma over the last couple of years has been a realization that certainly the immune system may be fooled and not getting rid of the melanoma, but what appears to be potentially more important is that the immune system in some cases is being actively recruited to help the melanoma grow. And this is a little paradoxical from what we used to think. And Susanna Topelian at Johns Hopkins presented some incredible studies looking at PD-1 and PD-L1. This is a checkpoint that's in the immune system that normally comes up when the immune system's involved in a reaction. But if the tumors express PD-L1 on their surface, she showed that this expression was induced by the immune system infiltrating into the tumor and trying to fight it. The tumor fights back with PD-L1. And what she showed very nicely, and others I'll mention in a second, was that if you block this interaction, the immune system's allowed to keep going on its positive effect of getting rid of the tumor. So one of the drugs highlighted was a compound from BMS, so BMS-936558, which is an anti-PD-1 antibody. And Dr. Hody presented a phase 1 study looking at this antibody in a variety of tumor types, not just melanoma. This is a humanized antibody that goes in and blocks this this interaction between the immune system and the tumor, unleashes the immune system to keep the fight up. Last year, we knew about CTLA-4 blockade. This year, it's PD-1. The exciting thing of PD-1 is that it appears we may have a predictive marker. Again, things are pretty early. But if you do not find that PD-L1 expressed on the tumors, Dr. Topelian showed that it was unlikely that you were going to respond to that blockade. So a predictive marker that lets us direct these therapies. It's important because the therapies have toxicities. There were grade 3-4 toxicities, which are significant toxicities of fatigue, rash, diarrhea, lowering of the lymphocyte counts. Compared to the drug before this, which is a poster child for immune therapy right now, CTLA-4 blockade, while these were significant, they appeared potentially less often than what we were seeing with CTLA-4 blockade. So exciting time in that we have potentially a predictive marker for a response and a drug that may be a little less toxic. So much excitement around this molecule is being generated that it's not just Bristol-Myers, but a phase 1 study from Merck was also presented, and that's MK-3475. Again, carrying on the theme that this was a phase 1 study looking at a lot of tumor types. But in both of these studies, what struck out in addition was that it's not just melanoma. This relationship between the immune system, as the last speaker said, may be important in head and neck cancer, but also for lung cancer patients, kidney cancer patients. There were even responses in ovarian cancer patients, which aren't typically thought of as targets of immune therapy. So it could be that we're gaining insights into other therapeutic strategies that'll go across the board on solid tumors. As these are broad, some of the topics that I think that were important for melanoma were actually in the developmental therapeutics section. And I'll just say one that's a little bit outside the realm of melanoma, and that's presented by Dr. Hatem Soliman. And he was in the developmental therapeutics section looking at IDO inhibition. So potentially a oral medication that targets another immune escape pathway that are important in tumors, and showed that stable disease was observed in both melanoma, colon cancer, as well as sarcomas, with manageable side effects and good clinical benefit. So I think the future for melanoma and solid tumor oncology is bright. I think what we're getting now are new tools that take us out of what we were doing before, was trying to optimize some of our chemotherapies and really opening the door to personalized medicine and targeting aspects of the immune system, which will allow us to sequence these therapies, combine these therapies, lower toxicities, and take advantage of some of the predictive markers that are coming out of it. So hopefully that wasn't too much. There was a lot going on. I thank Cancer Care for letting me highlight some of the things in melanoma.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Daniels. That was really excellent, and you really did highlight those very important areas that for melanoma, and which there's quite a bit going on. So thank you so much. And this does actually conclude our medical presenters on the call today. And as you can see, they demonstrated and brought to you all the information that the particular cancers that they addressed highlights, or their expert review of those presentations from ASCO. And indeed, that meeting is so very important because it does bring researchers together who actually then can share their research and enhance your care. In concluding today's program, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone in coping with cancer. I do want you to know that you have access to all the services of cancer care. We have a staff of 35 oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services to you, from individual counseling to practical assistance and practical support, practical financial assistance, as well as support. We also have support groups on the telephone, online, and, of course, these workshops and various materials as well. Most importantly, do call us with any question or concern you have. We are simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.